I think that all of us have these very deep feelings of tenderness.
You get stronger as you become more open.
If I can be vulnerable, that'll help other people be vulnerable.
And it doesn't work for me to be silent.
I can't believe I'm going to tell you this story, but I'm going to tell you this story.
This is the first time that I've told aloud.
If I could have known that you and I were alike, I would have had so much more hope.
Listening to other people's stories, you realize,
wow, these people are all experiencing the same thing that we are.
You are not the only one.
Welcome to Safe Space Radio's Healthcare Education Podcast on Addiction. At the end of this show, please go back to our website to answer a few questions that will help reinforce some of the important clinical takeaways. Your feedback will also help us learn more about the value of hearing our patients as teachers about what these illnesses are really like. This episode takes on the difficult topic of addiction. We explore some universal themes common to addiction and include both expert and personal accounts about specific substance use disorders. Alcoholism, smoking, and opioid use provide the framework for our discussion. While the rise in opioid use and related deaths has been brought into focus in recent years, the rates of death from tobacco and alcohol are significantly higher and are the first and third cause of preventable death in the United States, respectively. We will highlight the cycles of shame, guilt, and control that are all too present for those who struggle with substance use. Our guests, including a family therapist, clinical psychologist, documentary filmmaker, and mother, provide a variety of perspectives on what it's like to live with addiction. We begin by hearing from family therapist Mike Elkin, author of the book Families Under the Influence.
There's a system of thought. In other words, there's a belief system which is very prevalent, not only in this country, but I think in most Northern European countries. And part of that system of thought is that the belief that a good person is in control of themselves and pretty much in control of everything they should be in control of. And certainly that means their emotions and their appetites. So a person who is accused of addiction is being accused of not being in control of their actions and appetites, and being excessive and being bad.
Yes.
So that person feels shamed, and there, and also, if a person is addicted, that means they have very powerful parts who believe in order to just survive, to get through the day, they need something. And when somebody is accused of addiction, that makes those parts that need that thing feel that their supply to it might be threatened. In other words, if you say to somebody, you're an alcoholic, what it means is they're supposed to stop drinking.
Right.
And if there are parts of them that really need alcohol, those parts think, oh my God, my supply of alcohol is being threatened. And they feel very much like somebody would feel if they were in debt and they were fired from their job.
Right.
Or they depended on, you know, some agency for food and the agency said, we've got to stop feeding you.
Right, so we're talking about a survival threat.
Right, that's the way it feels, because certain parts have learned to associate whatever a person is addicted to, and people can be addicted to anything.
Say more. Give some examples of what might be something.
Well, people can be addicted to making money. People can be addicted to admiration. People can be addicted to being responded to as sexually attractive. People can be addicted to gambling. People can be addicted to anything at all, running.
Yes, and so then what makes it addictive? How do you define...
Okay, what I'm saying is addiction is a kind of relationship, and you can have that kind of relationship to anything.
Yes, and it's a kind of relationship where you believe you need something in order to take care of the part of you that thinks it's defective?
Right. What I believe is that we develop addictive relationships to somebody that we have had an experience where we associate whatever that we're addicted to the power to stop us from feeling shame, or the power to really change the way we experience shame. You know, one example I give is, you know, a teenage boy who's out on the street with a bunch of kids, and he's pretty insecure, and he's afraid that the popular kids are going to reject him, and they start passing this can of a liquid around, and as he drinks more of it, he discovers he becomes less, first of all, physically tense, and then the thoughts that he's going to be immediately rejected sort of go out of his mind, and he begins to feel comfortable and confident in the group, and therefore the more comfortable, confident parts of him begin to express themselves and say funny things, and he gets good feedback from the other people around him.
Right.
And so essentially he has found something that seems to give him the power to turn himself into what he wants to be, and also to really lessen his experience of the parts of him that think he's inadequate or not good enough or defective in some way. And so 20 years down the pike, you know, when he's waking up in a detox and people are trying to convince him that alcohol is ruining his life, part of him knows that's true, but there's another part of him that associates drinking alcohol with the certain knowledge it doesn't have to be this bad and it can be better, and that he knows that it worked for him.
Right.
And therefore, there's this part of him that thinks that basically the way he can be safe and happy is to find a way to get alcohol to work for him again, because it knows it did.
Right, and it doesn't have an alternative.
And the same thing could happen if you feel unlovable and inadequate and somebody seems to love you or need you or want you for something.
Right.
Or you win a bet or you lose. You know, there's the logic of this can be very indirect and tangled, but that's what I think happens, is people have an experience that with something that they, it feels to them like it gives them the hope that things don't always have to be that bad and they don't always have to feel bad about themselves.
And that gives us an understanding for the power of it. So I want to follow up, Mike, by saying there is a paradox here, it seems, because on the one hand, the substance or this relationship seems to give a relief from shame, and yet so often the things that a person can be addicted to seem to generate more shame. They seem out of control and seem only to make it worse.
Yeah, actually, always. I mean, one aspect of the addictive relationship is over time it generates more and more shame, more and more isolation. And your relationship to whatever you're addicted to, essentially whatever you're addicted to demands exclusivity. It demands that you take this relationship over all other relationships. In fact, that's one way that you can tell you're addicted to something, is if when you are faced with a choice between your relationship to whatever you think you might be addicted to and being able to feel comfortable or tell the truth to people who are important in your life, and you find yourself choosing whatever you suspect you're addicted to, you're addicted to it.
I see. So if you find yourself not telling the truth about it to someone you care about, that's when you know you've started to cross a line?
That's a really good indication. You know, in AA, if you go to an AA meeting, they have, at least many of them, I'm not sure this is still, but they have a list of 22 things, questions about your drinking to, you know, for people to evaluate whether they are suffering from alcoholism or not. And, you know, do you drink in the morning, blah, blah, blah. And I have a one-question test.
Yes.
And that question is, do you lie about your drinking?
Mm.
Because one of the if you lie to somebody in a personal relationship, what you're essentially saying to that person is, who I experience myself as being, I don't believe to be adequate to be in a relationship with you, so I'm going to pretend to be this other person who I hope you'll find acceptable. Which means essentially you're giving up all your power in that relationship. And also what it means is whatever you get in that relationship doesn't belong to you. It belongs to whoever you're pretending to be. Now, the other person may not know this at all, but you know it.
Right. So inside you start to feel ashamed even more.
So, for instance, if you and I were married and I'm drinking a bottle of liquor every day and you say, did you have anything to drink today? And I say, oh, no, well, I had one drink. Immediately you become my enemy. You're like the police who are trying to catch me in a crime.
Mm-hmm.
And that what I know is if you really knew what I was doing, you wouldn't love me.
Mm-hmm.
So if you relax and you have fun with me and are humorous and friendly and loving, that to me feels like an attack because I know I don't deserve it.
Mm. So you can't win.
And I find myself getting angry at you.
Uh-huh.
Which may feel sort of mysterious to you, seeing as you thought you were having a good time and being nice.
I thought I was being warm and loving.
Right.
Right.
You have your nerve.
So, okay, so let me just say this back to you to make sure I get this. So the addict, let's call him the alcoholic for the sake of keeping it simple, lies about their drinking. The partner doesn't know the lie, at least in the beginning maybe. It behaves in a loving way, and even then the addict feels threatened because it feels like they're loving a false person that's not them.
That's right. They're pretending to be somebody they know they're not.
Right.
And they're also giving the other person the power to essentially drive them out of themselves.
Because that person
could pretend to be this other person. And of course, then they're going to resent anybody who has that kind of power.
Now, wait a second. So is the power to expose the lie or the power to make them feel false?
Yes.
Both. Okay.
Yeah. And it doesn't matter whether they ever know that the person lied or not. Because all of this takes place between parts within the person who is suffering from the addiction.
I see. It's their internal struggle that's going on.
And the other person is just essentially a player in their game. And they may not know they're a player in the game. In fact, you know, very often doesn't.
So let me ask, because I get this question a lot. So for the family member who loves someone with an addiction and who begins to understand that the addiction is truly based in shame, as you've explained, how can the family member be helpful? How can they be loving in a way that actually matters?
It is very hard for them to do that. I mean, one thing they need to know that's useful is that if they talk about what's going on, they need to talk about themselves and their experience of it and not talk about the other person or expose their theories of why the other person is doing what they're doing.
Hmm.
So they can talk about the fact that when this other person drinks, they feel frightened and they feel cut off from them. And they feel like a bottle has just sort of landed between the two of them. And rather than being able to talk to the other person, they have to talk to this bottle instead. And they feel that, but it's how they feel.
Mm-hmm.
And not talk about what the other person is doing or why they think the other person is doing it.
Right.
I don't know whether that'll help, but it gives them a chance to express themselves without it being absolutely guaranteed that the other person is going to hear that as an attack on them and therefore respond from protective parts who are listening to them to make them wrong.
Right, and when you say an attack on them, it sounds like you also meant before an attack on their supply, that they might
That's
be cut
true.
Off from
it's
the very thing.
It's an attack on their character, on their sense of innocence, which is not, you know, which is very vulnerable. And it's also possibly an attack on their primary relationship, because essentially every addict is having an affair
with this
on whoever they're in relationship with, and they prefer this addictive relationship. It's not that they prefer it. They are more loyal to it than they are to any human relationship.
And that's because it gave them, at one point, some relief from their shame.
Right. But as you said, it generates more pain, which needs more relief, which generates more pain, which needs more relief, which is one of the reasons it keeps getting worse.
Right. I can understand that.
And so the opposite of addiction is relationship. And that's, the 12-step programs, although they have, a lot of things about them that make them hard for addicts to use effectively, what they are essentially doing is creating room for the person inside themselves and helping the person be in relationships that aren't either an or relationships with their addictive medium, whatever it is, alcohol, drugs, gambling, pornography, whatever it is.
This process of creating space for healthy, fulfilling relationships is challenging and certainly not as easy as it may sound. Our next guest, documentary filmmaker and rock climber Roger Amory, described what it's like to struggle with smoking tobacco for almost 30 years, despite many attempts to quit. According to data from the CDC in 2015, he is not alone, as only 7.8% of smokers have successfully quit within the past year, despite 68% of smokers reporting wanting to. Here's my conversation with Roger.
So I wonder if you might just start by telling me the story of your relationship with smoking. How did it get started? How did it feel when you first started smoking?
It all started in the basement of my parents' house when I was about 13, and my parents would leave me finally without a babysitter, and I'd tear down to the basement and start smoking my father's cigarettes.
So your dad smoked?
Both my parents smoked.
Okay, so this was like this gesture of independence and freedom, like, I don't need a babysitter, I'm on my own?
Well, I don't know. That makes a lot of sense, but I think it was maybe the urge toward maturity and like, oh, I'm a grown-up. Yeah, so yes, yeah.
Yeah, and had your parents given you any messages about smoking?
That it was totally okay. I remember lighting cigarettes for my parents. There was nothing taboo about it. In the culture that they were raised in, it was just part of the atmosphere.
All right, so it's so different from today. It's hard to imagine a parent in today's culture doing that.
In this country, in today's culture, it's hard to imagine.
What was it like to become a smoker? Did it change anything for you? What was your early experience of being a smoker?
I think I remember the first time that I sensed the benefits. Mm. And that was, I was working a boat show, I think at the Worcester Auditorium. And it was a chance for me, because I was selling boats at the time. I was like this salesperson, you come to me and maybe you want to buy a boat. And my boss didn't want people smoking around potential customers, which makes sense. And so I had to sort of walk away and take myself apart to have a cigarette. And I remember thinking, well, this is kind of a good setup. It's a sanctioned break. It's almost like the cliche, smokers don't work as hard and they take all these smoke breaks. And
I'd never heard that. People think that smokers don't work as hard?
Well, no, not that they don't work as hard, I think, but there is this myth out there that smokers don't work as much, because they're forced to leave the job site to have a cigarette. And it's I think probably less and less often is it a sanctioned break. But it still is in some ways.
Right, because people want you to be at a distance because they don't want to breathe it.
Right.
I see. So the first benefit was really a feeling of like, I get a break. I get a breather.
Yeah.
From work.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that makes total sense to me.
Yeah.
It's so interesting. It's like when you think about policymakers thinking about how to reduce the incidence of smoking, I think people think that making people go away is some form of social punishment to reduce, but in fact, it really backfired for you.
Not punishment for me.
Right.
Yeah.
In fact, quite desirable.
Space, absolutely.
Yeah.
It's like we were talking about how me smoking creates space between myself and the world and others.
So it's like a buffer.
Totally a buffer.
Yeah. What other benefits does it give you?
I love the tactility of it. There's a sensual pleasure in it for me.
Like the feel of the paper?
The feel of the sharp corners on the box, the feel of the sort of smooth paper of the cigarette, the feel of the filter, but you know, on my lips, between my lips. It's the tactility of it is, I think, where I get pleasure. The actual sensation of the smoke and the taste of it is not pleasurable for me.
Really? After all these years, it's not pleasurable?
Yeah. Right now, the taste in my mouth, I mean, I taste the nicotine all over my tongue, and it's not a pleasant taste.
Is it noxious, or is it just neutral?
Well, I mean, I'm accustomed to it.
Yeah.
But if I was not accustomed to it, I mean, I'd have to imagine it would be noxious. It's, you know.
Right. So you're used to it, but it's really, there's no pleasure in that for you. It's not about the taste at all.
It's not about the taste. Now, the actual kind of neurological hit.
Yeah.
That serves me.
Okay, so tell me more about the hit. That's
well,
what I was
asking. Well, it's almost like a reset button, a touchstone. You know, if my wife and I are in some tense place, it's very helpful for me to walk out onto the porch and smoke a cigarette, and I kind of regather myself. It's almost like the reboot, reset button.
Mm. And more than just being able to walk out on the porch and take a breather from some intense interaction.
That's unclear.
Yeah.
Yeah. My sense is yes, and I wish that that were untrue. I wish that I could walk away in a tense situation with my wife and in the course of 4 minutes or 5 minutes feel like I could return to, you know, a grounded, comfortable place.
Right.
And I'm not claiming that I can smoke a cigarette and become grounded and comfortable.
Right.
But I can move closer to that state.
Uh-huh. So it's almost like it reconnects you with yourself a little bit.
Perhaps. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, there's a reset function, I'm just thinking.
Yeah.
Huh.
Yeah.
Is it also that it gives you, I mean, so often when couples are fighting, things escalate and it's so hard to know how to take a break without the other person thinking you're abandoning them or shutting them out.
Mm-hmm.
Is there sort of a sanctioned way to take a break where she knows it's only going to be for a brief amount of time so she doesn't get upset with you for doing it?
Well, that's a good question. And that's a little sticky because you know both of us.
I do.
And I would say in our case, no. And I think it's also true, at least in my relationship with my wife, that we are able to say, okay, hang on a second here. Let's just take a break.
I mean, it's challenging for everybody
to do
that.
It is hard. Yeah, that is hard.
Yeah.
That is hard.
The advantage of a smoke break, I can imagine, is that, you know, one knows that that's not such a long time. Whereas if, you know, if a spouse storms off and shuts the door, you know, never. When are they coming back? It could be even more threatening, maybe.
Yeah, it's finite. It's discreet.
Yeah.
Discreet in terms of time.
Yes. So I want to shift now to your, you know, fast forward many years to your attempts to quit. And when you first wanted to quit, how come and how did that go?
I'm trying to think the first time when I was living in Utah, I was on this sort of like, you know, meditation, yoga, purity thing as a smoker.
Right.
And really felt like, you know, if I could eliminate this smoke from my life, I might enhance my experience. And to be honest with you, I still believe that. I think, you know, that notion is right on. So, you know, I started really smoking addictively when I was 19. And it was probably only 4 years later, maybe five, where I was like, all right, it's time to stop. I need to stop. And I cycled and have continued to cycle through attempts to stop. You know, I'm 47. As I was about to turn 30, I'll definitely stop by the time I'm 30, you know. 40, I'll definitely stop by the time I'm 40. You know, I've gone and I've tried Wellbutrin,
yep.
You know, which completely whacked me out. Acupuncture, hypnosis, you know, the only thing that has been successful for me is to replace the cigarettes with something else that can serve as a reset button. And the primary example for me is intense exercise. But I'm really just replacing, you know, one drug with another.
Mm-hmm. Although you could argue you're trading up. It's an upgrade. A free upgrade.
I know. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
And you, when the way you're talking about it is almost as if that's somehow not okay to do. Is there something that feels lesser about replacing it?
It doesn't feel greater or lesser. It just feels like a move sideways. Now, when I, you know, it is a healthier choice, no question. Absolutely no question. And perhaps it's the direction I'm moving. I don't know. But I mean, my point is I've cycled through lots of different tries.
Yeah.
So, some as long as 8 or 9 months.
You haven't been smoking for 8 months, and then something happens and you start again. What is the process inside your mind that where you decide to smoke?
The first thing that came to mind was a sense of entitlement. Like, I deserve this. This is something I can give to me.
Yeah.
You know, this is my own.
Right.
That's the first thing that comes to mind. Coupled with that is this complete sense of a failure. You know, I realize that's the topic of your show, but that is the experience for me. Like, here I am again. I've just lasted 8 months, and here I am again smoking.
Yeah.
And the transition back to kind of a comfortable rationalization for my relationship with cigarettes, that transition back to that place of comfort is riddled with shame and guilt. Going into the store, buying a pack of cigarettes, I'm like, I can't believe I'm doing this, even though I fantasized about doing it every single day for the last 9 months. Here I am yet again, walking into a convenience store and asking for a pack of cigarettes.
Right. And are you imagining, do you have a dialogue in your head about what the cashier is thinking about you? Or is it really all internal?
No, it's internal. I don't.
And so for those 8 or 9 months, you've fantasized about this every day. Have you ever had a try at quitting where you didn't fantasize about it every day?
Not that I can remember, Anne.
Yeah, well, that feels really important. So there's some way that it was always the longing was
well,
so
it's
strong.
An addiction. And I, you know, you may or may not be blessed to have not really lived experientially an addiction. But I think that's part of the nature of addiction.
Yeah.
You know, here's what I'm addicted to. Take it away from me. I want it. And I want it now, and I want it now, and I want it now.
And later, and later, and then
right.
I'll want it too.
Right.
Yes. Yes. And so for you, so there you are. You're going back into the store. You have this rationalization going that's comfortable and familiar, but at the same time, you're feeling riddled with, oh, God, I can't believe I'm doing this. Has that ever served you? Has that ever gotten you out of the store before you bought it?
I don't think if I've walked in with the intention of buying a pack of cigarettes, no. By the time I'm like, okay, all right, I'm going to smoke a cigarette, you know, I create some little construct that allows me to do that, and I do it.
Yeah. And what would be an example of a construct?
I'll just smoke one.
Ah, okay. Just this one.
Yeah, just this one. And I will do that for a month or two. I'll buy a pack of cigarettes, $6 a pop. I'll smoke one cigarette and then get rid of the pack of cigarettes.
Every day for a month?
I've done that maybe not for a month, but certainly for 2 weeks.
Right.
Certainly.
So it's like this tortured struggle every day.
Oh, brutal.
Oh, God, it sounds brutal.
Brutal. Yeah.
Brutal. And so one side of you is saying, I deserve this. I need a break. This is all mine. And another side is saying, I can't believe you can't do this. Do you go to the place of, like, what's wrong with you? How come other people can do this?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Because most of my friends were smokers before I met them, you know, and they were able to quit smoking. Many of them say, oh, I'd continue to smoke if I didn't know that it was so unhealthy for me.
And how does it feel when they say that to you?
Well, it in a way, it sanctions my smoking because I'm not the only one that feels pleasure from this.
Wants to be smoking.
I know that.
Right.
I know that. And because they've been able to get rid of their addiction and I have not, it makes me think like, well, what's up with me? You know, what made them able to do it and not me?
Roger describes periods in his life when he wanted to beat addiction, which in itself can be an elusive first step towards change. Many people, friends, families, and clinicians struggle with how to encourage this desire and incentive for change in others. Motivational interviewing was first introduced in 1983 as a way of connecting with individuals struggling with problematic alcohol use. Motivational interviewing is described as a collaborative, person-centered form of guiding to elicit and strengthen motivation for change. It focuses on gently eliciting an individual's own reasons for change and avoids confrontational or authoritative approaches. We continue our discussion of addiction by hearing more about the impact alcoholism can have on children and families from Dr. Louise Zubrod.
Louise is a psychologist with 28 years of experience. She's in private practice here in Portland. She works primarily with women, but also with couples and groups. Louise is a mother, a stepmother, a grandmother, and a mother-in-law. She has a particular interest and expertise in the impact of alcoholism on families. Welcome, Louise.
Thank you. It's lovely to be here with you. Well, a huge proportion of the population, one of the figures that comes up again and again in the literature is that there are 76 million Americans 12 years old and older who have alcoholism in their families.
And that doesn't even get to the people who are under 12.
Under 12, exactly.
Which would presumably double the figure.
And it also doesn't get at friends, beloved friends that you care about may be afflicted with addictions.
Right. So 76 million people have an immediate family relative who is out of control with alcohol.
And their experience of family as well as of the world is skewed by that.
Yeah, so let's talk more about that. What are some of the other ways that it gets skewed?
Well, I think someone talked to me recently about this, and she was talking about the person, the alcoholic in her family, and she said that the addiction is just, it's like this vortex that sucks all the energy in. So the energy is not available for things that are needed in everyday life, like being really present in your children's lives. If it's a parent, for example, a mother or a father who has a problem with addiction, they do not have the energy, nor does the family, because the non-alcoholic parent may be much more oriented towards the alcoholic parent and towards maintaining basic things like getting bills paid and income in and so forth. And so the children don't get the kind of attention that children need and certainly need to succeed.
Yeah, and so when you say that the non-alcoholic parent is focused on the one who's drinking, is that because they're trying to manage it and they're scared and they're trying to act in ways that might prevent it? I mean, they're sort of getting all caught up in trying to diminish the harm.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. Diminish it within the family, do damage control in terms of how the family looks in the neighborhood, in the community. Keeping the secret is enormous.
Mm-hmm. Tell me more about that.
Well, I for some reason or other have always remembered this story of Claudia Black's that I heard so many years ago. She talked about a child telling her that they had run out the door and found their father passed out on the front lawn. Mm. So they ran back into the house and up to the mom and said, "Daddy's sick, Daddy's sick." And the mother said, "What's going on?" "Well, he's out on the front lawn." And the mother said, oh, he's not sick. He's camping.
Oh. So it's crazy making for the child.
Exactly.
So their reality is completely distorted and denied.
Yes. And so then there gets to be a lack of self-trust on any number of levels, both in terms of, am I wrong? This person, maybe the child even says, are you okay? Mommy or daddy mean, have you been drinking? And the parent says, fine. And they're staggering or slurring.
Right. So they get this break then between what their senses, their perception is telling them is reality and what the person is telling them.
Exactly.
And then they don't know who to believe and whether they can trust what they're seeing.
And as you know, children know when something's wrong.
Right.
They may not have the specifics, but they'll be asking what's wrong.
Right.
And when they're told nothing, everything's fine, I always kind of get my antenna up when an adult comes in saying things like, they're fine.
Right. That word fine is a red flag for you, Dr.
It sure
Zubra.
Is. Yes. Right. I mean, I remember I was fine for many years. Mm-hmm. And really what that meant was that I didn't think I should be looking at my own emotional life.
Okay, say what you mean by that. And how come? Why would you not?
Well, because the adults really didn't have the emotional availability to be very interested in my available life, so my emotional life. So I learned that it wasn't particularly interesting and that really what was interesting was what was going on with the alcoholic.
Mm-hmm. So you were learning that paying attention to your emotional world was not of value.
Exactly.
And was it even shameful or bad? I mean, was there a prohibition against it?
There wasn't an explicit prohibition, but there was in the sense that it wasn't happening. I mean, I tried pretty much everything to get attention periodically.
Right.
I tried acting out.
Yes.
And I would get negative attention for that, and then that really wasn't very comfortable. So I tried achieving in school and would get a little bit of attention. But it's incredibly difficult to be high achieving in school when you don't have a lot of parental involvement.
Mm-hmm.
And over time, I think that I really became very comfortable with not being in the limelight.
I see. In fact, if you were saying before that you tried to make yourself scarce when people were drunk, did it feel safer to not be in the limelight?
Absolutely.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Right. But then, of course, what does that do to your own potential? I mean, ways that you might really shine. So those kind of get muted or
exactly
rendered more invisible.
Yeah. When I was doing my doctoral work at Boston University, someone there was doing a dissertation on female gold medal Olympic women, athletes. And one of the variables that was always present was a strong relationship with the father.
Really? How interesting.
But I think it's really so clear that it's children whose parents give energy to them, time, attention, interest.
Yes.
Encouragement.
I know there's when you talk about the drinking as the vortex into which all the energy gets sucked, there's a John Prine song about a guy who's addicted to a heroin, and they said there's a hole in daddy's arm where all the money goes.
Mm.
And it feels very much like what you're talking about.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
This sort of enormously powerful vacuum that sucks everything good into it.
Right.
Yeah.
And at the same time, you have the things that you're supposed to do. You're supposed to be going to school. You're supposed to be making the family look good. You're not supposed to be telling the secret.
Yeah, so say more about that, because secrets, I know, are so powerful.
Right.
Did you get told you shouldn't tell the secret, or how did you learn that?
Well, I think I learned it by asking my parents to talk to me about the substance abuse or about why they were upset when there wasn't an external thing that happened, but there was substance abuse. And then they might escalate into anger, and it was hard to understand.
I didn't follow you. When you said there wasn't an external thing that happened, I'm not sure I know what you mean.
Well, for example, some people who are drinking get really angry.
Yeah.
I mean, it's alcohol is implicated in over 80% of family violence incidents.
Mm. I see. So you mean when there's no obvious trigger.
Right.
But the person is just suddenly furious.
Yes, exactly.
I
That's
see.
Exactly.
And then what was really going on is that they were drinking.
And to ask about why would you be angry or try to understand it made them angrier.
Right. So you learned that when you tried to name it or move toward it, talking about it, the reaction was one of anger.
It was one of anger.
Uh-huh. So you learned to keep quiet about it.
Yeah.
And did you ever talk about it outside, like with teachers or other parents, and feel censored for that?
No, I didn't. I didn't. I mean, I knew this was about our family. And I very much grew up thinking that other people had a different kind of family where this didn't happen. And so I was embarrassed.
Yeah, so there was shame.
Yes. Yeah.
And so you imagine that, of course, now we know how many other families, in fact, this is happening.
Yes, exactly.
But at the time, you imagined that this was something really shameful about your family. So the secret wasn't just about your parents, it became about you.
Yes. And I think the other part of that that's was difficult for me and is difficult for everyone in this situation is that, of course, the way children construct reality, if bad things are happening in your world, you assume that you have done something to cause it.
Right.
So for myself and many other people, you come out of that situation feeling guilty. And it's a kind of non-specific, nameless, if this bad thing is happening, I must have some part in it having happened.
Yeah, so that when you say it's non-specific and nameless, so it's this kind of low-level thing that's hard to even get at.
Yes.
It's hard to even know you're carrying it.
Yes.
Because it's sort of very pervasive, but chronic.
Right.
Yes. And somehow the feeling is that something bad about me. I'm not sure what it is, but
right.
That's why this is all happening.
Yes.
I want to shift gears now a little bit to talk about some of the other consequences. You know, we've been focused mostly on the emotional consequences for the kids, but you mentioned 80% of family violence associated with alcoholism. And I wondered if you could talk a little bit about some of the other consequences, you know, concrete consequences for people around drinking.
Sure. Sure. There's, for example, if a woman drinks when she's pregnant, there's fetal alcohol syndrome. And I've actually gotten to work with parents trying to parent children whose birth parents have been, alcohol involved. And when it's severe, and the number is something like 5,000 or so severe cases of fetal alcohol syndrome a year, and 35,000 in this country of milder. It's
35,000 mild fetal alcohol cases
a year
in the U.S.
Yes.
Which is a huge number, because this is not a reversible condition.
It's not reversible, and it so impacts every aspect of the child's life.
Maybe you could say a little bit about what the impact of fetal alcohol is on the child.
For me, the worst that could happen is that there be an attachment difficulty, and it's my understanding that often, but not always, children with fetal alcohol syndrome have difficulty with attachment.
And why don't you explain what that is for people?
Well, for example, the first, I think about things developmentally, and of course the first year or two that a child is alive, their job is to learn that the world is a trustworthy place.
Mm-hmm.
And of course we're talking about now babies coming in and sometimes needing to go through withdrawal and detox and then be left with pretty significant neurologic problems, hyperactivity, attentional problems, so that work, sustaining eye contact, all of the things we take for granted in other children are really very difficult for these children.
Mm-hmm.
There are some wonderful studies being done. One that I read by the National Association for Children of Alcoholics talked about how the level of dysfunction or resiliency on the part of the non-alcoholic parent is the key factor in determining whether there will be problems in the children or not, or to what extent there'll be problems. So if the dad, for example, is still being captured by alcohol, but the mom gets herself to a recovery program or therapy or treatment for families of alcoholics, she can bring to the children the benefits of that, and they can break the not healthy rules of the alcoholic family, like keeping the secret.
Right. So let's talk a little bit about the unhealthy rules of the alcoholic family. So one of them is to keep a secret,
to not
talk about it.
Really, what we're saying to children when we do that is, this is such a terrible thing that it can't be spoken.
Right.
And when we do talk about it, we say, this is a very bad thing, and your poor parent has struggles with it, and it's not so bad that we can't talk about it. Here are some things we can do.
Right.
And that includes not allowing the rituals to go down the tubes. But I had wonderful experiences in my own time in Al-Anon, which is such a healing, gentle recovery program, and teaches the person to take care of themselves, even though their partner, parent, whatever, is not well. But I met a woman there who would say to her husband, who was still then drinking, "Here's what we're going to do about Christmas. If you choose to drink, we will go to my mother's. And if you don't, then we'll stay home with you. It's up to you." Uh-huh. And she said that with compassion and really permission giving. Do what you need to do. And we're going to do what you need to do. So you don't have to worry about that. We're going to have a good Christmas anyway.
Right. So when you said don't let the rituals go down the tubes, that's what you mean.
I mean rescue. Christmas, rescue graduations. Don't let the alcohol become the central issue. Let the family values be explicit in those things.
Yeah. So two of the rules we're breaking right now. So one is break the secret, talk about it. Another is take care of the family rituals that have meaning for the kids.
Exactly.
And if that means leaving the drinker behind and going and celebrating somewhere else, then do it.
Yes.
Are there other things?
Yeah, I think one is to really be aware of all the wonderful programs there are for families. In my own codependent way, which means I was addicted to the whole alcoholic system in its unhealthy way, but I dragged my children when I first went to Al-Anon, which is so not Al-Anon teaching. Mm-hmm. But they sometimes will drop in and they see it as a wonderful option for themselves.
Mm-hmm. So going into some kind of group treatment at Al-Anon partly is wonderful because it's everywhere and it's free.
It's free and people are loving and caring and not there to talk about the bad old alcoholic person.
So it's not just a session to trash someone else, but it's to focus on self-care.
Since this interview aired, a study published in 2018 revealed that the number of children with fetal alcohol spectrum disorders in the United States is likely 5 times greater than what we previously thought. Higher even than the number of children diagnosed with autism spectrum disorder. We'll turn now to opioid use disorder, which has become a national epidemic. In 2016, 116 people died each day in the U.S. from opioid-related drug overdoses, and 11.5 million people misused prescription opioids. In our final story, we hear from Lynn Ouellette about her son Brendan's struggle with opioid addiction. She describes the experience of watching her son succumb to addiction and the helplessness of not being able to protect him. One thing we tend to forget is that love isn't the same as help. We can love someone so much, and that doesn't mean we're going to be able to help them. Sometimes love isn't enough. Lynn learned this from her son, Brendan.
There was no room quite big enough for him. He just kind of loved life. He was a daredevil, a risk taker. He would clown around. I remember one Christmas my sister brought my boys Tinker Toys for Christmas, and one of my sons sat and played with the Tinker Toys, and Brendan put the container on his head and jumped around and made it fall off and had everyone in hysterics.
After Brendan graduated from high school, he was living with his parents. Lynn remembers he started acting oddly.
There was one time that he came into my office demanding money. He was in one of those states where he was really irritable and angry. And he was being relentless, and he was really intimidating, which was not his usual way with me. I found evidence of something that I didn't even know what it was, really. At that time, he was spending a lot of time in the basement, and I found tinfoil with these little burn circles on it. And so I started to look up on the internet, what does this mean? I tried to talk to him about it, but he didn't acknowledge anything.
Things started to get much worse.
And I always felt like no matter what, he and I had a connection. It might not be a warm, fuzzy connection, but I felt like he was connected to me. And I felt like I was losing that with him. And so at one point, I just sat down with him and I said, you have some choices here. You can go to one of these places that I've found. I had, I think, 3 rehabs. Or I'm going to go to the police. There isn't any other choice. Because I felt scared. I felt like he's going to die if I don't do something. And at that point, he just broke down and he said, okay, I will go. And it wasn't actually until he was ready to go that he told me that he had been using heroin.
When Lynn talks about Brendan, she talks a lot about shame.
But one of the things that was hard for him was that he didn't feel smart. He had to get help with reading when he was in the second grade, and he had to have some special classes and special support. And I think that really felt bad to him. No matter what you said to him, that felt bad to him. He was also diagnosed, not surprisingly, with ADHD. And all of this, I think, really affected his self-esteem. So I think some of his spirit got lost along the way. He became a little bit almost shy as he got older, and I think that was part of his feeling about himself. He, I think, had a lot of shame about ways in which he didn't feel good enough. And so rather than ask for help, I think he did things that he thought would make him feel better. And I think part of his way of coping became substances. He said to me one time, Mom, I don't use to get high. I use so I don't get sick.
Do you think that Brendan sort of had his own way of asking for help that was more indirect?
Yes. It was not only the words he used, but it was how he said them. And the sense that he conveyed how much of a struggle he was having, or the sense of desperation. And he looked pained about it. And he was like, I don't know what to do. What can I do? And to me, that was an ask for help. Times that he would acknowledge any kind of vulnerability seemed to me like it was an ask for him, because he didn't usually do that.
What was it like for you when he did, when he showed you that vulnerability?
It was a relief. Because I felt like he was so guarded much of the time, and so he had so much bravado a lot of the time, that when he took that down, there was a, you know, it was more like I could see the tender part of him, and I could actually reach that. I knew that was there.
Brendan spent 2 months in rehab. Lynn visited him during the final week.
At the end of the week, the recommended plan was that he not come home. It was that he go to an intensive residential program. And he didn't want to go. And he started to say, if you don't let me come home, I'll just leave here, and I'll find my own way home. I said, I can't, Brendan. I just can't. I'm still afraid that if you come home, you won't survive. And he said, so you're not gonna let me come home? And I said, no, I'm not gonna let you come home.
And I walked away in tears. It was very hard to leave. And I don't think I stopped crying till I got off the airplane. I just felt heartbroken. You know, like I'd abandoned him.
Despite Lynn's fears, Brendan completed his stay in the residential program.
And I actually remember when he came home, I was so, so happy to see him. Because I'd missed him, even though he had been such a pain. I was so happy to see him, and he looked so healthy.
But Brendan no longer had a driver's license, and he struggled to find a job. Lynn remembers him feeling stuck and becoming increasingly irritable and depressed.
And I started to worry about him, and I could tell something was going wrong.
Lynn became convinced that Brendan was using again. She expressed her concerns, but...
Sometimes he would say, I'm not using anything, you're crazy. You know, it's just, it was felt like there was no way in at that point. You know, I couldn't find the vulnerable spot, I couldn't find an opening. On the day that he overdosed. And this part's really hard. I saw him talk to someone in the driveway in a car. And I said to him, Brendan, who is that? Oh, it's just an old friend of mine, nobody you know. And then a little bit later, my husband yelled to me. And he found that he had overdosed in the basement. And he didn't actually die right away. He went to the hospital. My son and my daughter came home. We all did say goodbye. And we made a family decision to turn off the life support. Because he had so much brain damage. I used to think that if you loved someone enough, that would be the thing that would make you try hard enough, that would be the thing that would make a difference, that you'd be sort of unstoppable. And in a way, I feel like I was unstoppable, but it wasn't enough. That's why, you know, when it came time to do his obituary, I wanted to put that he died from addiction in there. I didn't feel ashamed of that. It felt really important to me to do it. It's important for people to acknowledge it. The more people that acknowledge it, the less shame there is. Brendan John Keating, born January 21st, 1991, of Brunswick, passed away on December 16th, 2013, after a fierce and courageous battle with the intractable disease of addiction.
Brendan's story is being replayed across the country. In 2017 alone, more Americans died of drug overdose than in the Vietnam and Iraq wars combined. Our culture tends to talk about addiction in moral terms, as a personal failure or a loss of willpower. But substance use often begins as a coping mechanism, a form of relief from things that make us feel ashamed, a solution that ironically compounds shame, making it even harder to ask for help. Shame not only makes it harder for us to get what we want, it can literally threaten our lives. 12-step programs have long popularized an all-or-nothing view of substance use, leading to a widespread belief that abstinence only is the best approach to treatment. But when it comes to opiates, the data suggest otherwise. In fact, only 10% of addicted people who try to stay off opiates will succeed. Research shows that medication such as prescribed methadone or Suboxone is by far the most effective treatment. It's also one of the most stigmatized and underfunded approaches nationwide. That concludes this episode of Safe Space Radio's Healthcare Education Podcast on Addiction. Please fill out the few quick questions on the website that will give you credit for listening and help to solidify some of the most important clinical takeaways. We'd be grateful, too, for your feedback about this show. Your responses will help us measure the impact of hearing stories from the people who know these struggles from the inside. Thank you to the Josiah Macy Jr. Foundation for their support of this project, our guests, our producers Gabe Graben and Caitlin Swalje, and our education coordinator, Sarah Powers. I'm Dr. Anne Hallward, and I invite you to check out the rest of our archive devoted to telling authentic and inspiring stories about the things we would struggle with less if we could talk about them more.